many, many, many more questions, New Testament as well as Old Testament questions. We have set aside this next hour until 4:15 for you to be able to do with Dr. Blomberg what others did during this last hour with Dr. Kaiser, and that is raise some of the thorny issues, theological, biblical, various issues related to the, in his case, the Old Testament text. Now we're going into the New Testament text, and Dr. Blomberg is here to, in this open forum now, answer the questions that you have. So if you would prepare to come to the microphone, and I think there's somebody over here ready to start out, we'll have you start with your question in just a few seconds. Also, to let you know that as soon as this session is finished, I'll come up and say a few more things at 4:15, and then we'll go right into the final afternoon lecture, which is about Da Vinci Code Part 2. And that will wrap up and complete the fascinating lecture that you started last night, Dr. Blomberg. So without any further ado, welcome Dr. Blomberg with me, if you would, and we will begin with our first question. So, and you can just go to the microphone.
Am I on?
Yep.
Good.
Thank you, Dr. Blomberg. My question has to do with sexuality, and specifically homosexuality. Dr. Kaiser could have answered the question from the Old Testament perspective. I'll shift it to the New Testament perspective. The New Testament word that many have trouble with, truluck and others, is arsenikoitai. It's used by Paul twice in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:10. And the theory is that Paul went back to the Septuagint, the translation of Hebrew Bible into Greek from Leviticus 20:13, where it condemns the sleeping of a man with a man as a man with a woman. And the words were meta, arsenos, koites, gunaikas. And it looks like Paul took the word arsenos, man, and koites, sexual intercourse, and slammed them together, coined a new word, which really didn't exist in Greek, and called it arsenikoitai. And that word in English translations today is homosexual. My question to you is arsenikoitai correctly translated in modern translations of English as homosexual? And does it have the same cultural connotation in Paul's time as it does in our time as a practicing homosexual?
Thank you. Everybody follow that? There are a number of words that are used throughout the Bible that get translated in various ways in English, including with English terms like homosexual or its equivalent. And in many ways, this is one of the more significant ones because what this gentleman has said is accurate. We have not discovered it used in any known Greek literature prior to Paul. And etymologically, it comes from two words that correspond to the English male plus coitus, intercourse. And the closest equivalent is that long list of sins, which many of them sexual, are called an abomination to God back in the book of Leviticus. I think it's significant because it's not one of the terms that was in coinage and could at times refer to a more narrow form of homosexual behavior, such as cult prostitution, such as pederasty, an adult male with an adolescent or even a prepubescent boy. So whereas with some texts, some people have made the argument that it's only certain kinds of homosexual sin or homosexual acts that are deemed sinful, I don't think that argument holds with this word. Is homosexual the best translation? Maybe not quite, because I think what male coitus suggests is that the focus is on the improper actions. And so maybe something like one who practices homosexual intercourse would be a better translation, but that becomes cumbersome. The issue is not someone's supposed orientation. My orientation, when I'm honest, and now I'll just say it in front of several hundred people, is towards heterosexual sin, but I try not to act on it. It's not orientation, but it's when you cross the line and actually commit acts of homosexual intercourse. That would be the best translation. But on the other hand, it's not a word where you can just narrow it down and say it's homosexual activity in this small corner or this little arena or something along those lines. Yes, please. Whoever's next. For all of you who were so patient last hour, I'm going to work hard at shorter answers.
Okay.
I don't have as much information memorized, so.
Matthew 27, 51 to 53.
Ah, yes, the saints.
Interesting portion of Scripture.
Indeed.
It says, "The earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many." Now, in the book, "Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up?", which is out there and which I believe you contributed to, Robert J. Miller says that there is no good reason to think that this event really happened, for it is mentioned nowhere else. Except for those already committed to literalism, very, very few biblical scholars would argue that Matthew 27, 51 to 53 is historical. End quote. He then goes on to argue that, seeing that this is ahistorical, we should then use that as a principle for reading Matthew and for reading the other Gospels as writing as if it were history, but not actually writing history. So my question is two-part. First, what do you do with that passage, those few verses, whether they're historical or not? And second, is that principle legitimate or not?
Well, I think the second question is the easier one. Even if you don't accept Dr. Kaiser's principle of innocent until proven guilty, and that itself is debated among historiographers, it certainly seems fair to say it's no more appropriate to take the hardest and most fantastic part of a piece of literature and write all the rest of it off as a result than it is to take the most sober, historically corroborated part of a piece of literature and use that as a reason for believing everything else in the document. Paul Barnett from Australia a few years ago wrote a book called Jesus and the Logic of History, where he uses the example from four different Roman historians who have all written about Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon River, that famous moment that, from 2020 hindsight, doomed the Republic and began the Empire, and shows how there are supernatural accounts of miracles in several of those Roman histories, and not one Roman historian, to our knowledge, ever has said as a result, therefore, we don't believe Caesar crossed the Rubicon. It's never a case of all or nothing. It's always what's more corroborable and less. So no, I don't think that method holds up. What do I do with it? It's an odd passage. The problem is not so much that it only occurs in Matthew. More than 50% of what occurs in the Gospels occurs only in one Gospel, and there are plenty of things people believe despite that. And it's not even so much that it's a resurrection, because Lazarus was raised, the widow of Nain's son, Jairus' daughter. It's that it seems to be not the kind of resurrection that people would then again die later, but it seems to be resurrection on the order of what happened to Jesus. And the best sense that I can make of it, even though the word isn't used there, is that it is a vivid illustration of what Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 would say, that Jesus' resurrection is the first fruit of the general resurrection of all humanity. Daniel 12:2, which during the intertestamental period, Jews regularly believed in, with the rare exception of the Sadducees. And so, in essence, what the story of Jesus and this unique group of saints, whoever they were, is pointing out is that the resurrection of all people has begun. But what's the surprise is, it's not all happening at once. It's triggered by Jesus and these few people as the first fruits, guaranteeing that the rest will still come.
One of the other things that Robert Miller makes, or one of the other points that he makes, is that not only is it not mentioned in any of their Gospels, which he would probably just write off as they used Matthew anyway, or they would have used each other anyway, but that it's not mentioned in Josephus or any of the other historians of that era.
There are only about a dozen things out of the Gospels that are mentioned in any other historians, so that's not much of an argument.
Okay.
Let's go here to the left.
Oh, sorry. I got so used to you standing over there last hour that I apologize.
Thank you to you and Dr. Kaiser for coming. We as Christians pride ourselves on having a faith that is in line with the evidence. Yet, I see within evangelical circles a certain doctrine that is preached, promulgated, that to me flies in the face of the preponderance of the evidence, and that would be the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. And I know there's a number of books on the market written by Christian scholars, even Dr. Kaiser, perhaps yourself even, that defend and try to explain the difficulties of different Bible passages. Yet there are other books also by skeptics which document problems. Like, for instance, I have a book here, Biblical Inerrancy, by Dennis McKenzie, in which he documents 5,000 errors which he considers in the Bible. My question is, why is this such an important doctrine for evangelicals, especially since it's not mentioned in any of the historic creeds, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, and the descriptions that I've heard is that it's actually a rather recent development from the Princeton School within the last century or two. Thanks.
I promise short answers. Oh, boy. this will be a challenge. In 1982, John Woodbridge wrote a book called Biblical Authority, which was a response to a slightly earlier book by two scholars by the name of Jack Rogers and Donald McKim, whose thesis was essentially the thesis that you've just articulated. And what Woodbridge said was, while the term inerrancy is a comparatively recent one, at least in terms of frequent usage, and for that matter, largely American and used in parts of the world where churches have been planted by Americans and American missionaries, the concept of the Bible as free from error, unable to deceive, always communicating truth, and therefore consistent with the conviction that it is uniquely God's revelation, is a view that one can trace right through all the major Orthodox thinkers of Orthodoxy, Catholicism, and Protestantism. And I refer you to his book for the evidence, which I think is very compelling. As someone who studied in Britain, as someone who has taught in Canada and Australia and in many parts of the former British Commonwealth, I'm very much aware that the rest of the evangelical world looks at Americans with a bit of an uplifted eyebrow as to why some American evangelicals place such a huge emphasis on inerrancy. And if somebody comes to me and says, I believe that the Bible is my unique and uniquely reliable guide as to how I should live and what I should believe, and I study it devoutly, and I have accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, and I do my best to serve Him, and I believe this is a document that is uniquely relevant and my guide for life. But I look at some of you and your quarrels about inerrancy, and I just can't go there. I say, welcome, brother. I'm not going to try to argue with you. That's not something worth fighting over. But having been trained at Trinity before I went overseas, having been taught by people like Dr. Kaiser and others, I became aware that thoughtful American inerrantists, which is a subset of the sum total of American inerrantists, have, as for example, in the book that I saw out there on the bookshelves, edited now 25 years ago by Norman Geisler, simply called Inerrancy, presented very nuanced definitions that in essence say whatever the Bible affirms, back to Dr. Kaiser's point about authorial intention, don't make it say something it was never intending to say, but interpret it in light of its genre, in terms of interpret it in light of its time and its historical background, its literary context, whatever we can most probably reconstruct that the writer was trying to say is true. That's all inerrancy means, necessarily. And if that's all, and it doesn't say anything about levels of precision, it just means whatever is being affirmed is true. That's what you mean by inerrancy. I can sign a statement, which is good because I have to where I teach.
I had a question about the role of women, especially in 1 Corinthians 11 and
oh,
1
brother.
Timothy 2.
Sorry.
Where, you know, Paul says women should wear a veil over their hair, that they're not permitted to speak in church, and that they're being saved through childbirth.
You want to do all three of them? Oh, my goodness. Well, it doesn't say they should wear a veil over their hair. It says they should have a covering on their head, and it's disputed whether the covering is an external covering like a veil or a shawl, or whether the external covering is long hair itself. Get a copy of the 1984 edition of the NIV and look at the giant footnote, and you can see the two very different ways to translate that. There are about eight different major possible historical cultural background influences to explain that, and I didn't bring my nice little PowerPoint diagram of them with me. But basically, they all boil down to one of two things. Whether it was an external covering or whether it was long hair versus short hair on women versus men, respectively, to not have followed Paul's instructions would have very probably communicated nonverbally to a Greek and Roman community with a small Jewish minority population like Corinth that the man or the woman in question was either sexually unfaithful to his or her spouse or religiously loyal to some god other than the God of Father of Jesus. So contemporary application, if that's what something on your head does or not on your head suggests, we ought to avoid it today as well. If not, it's morally irrelevant. But then the question is, are there other things about our dress, our appearance, our demeanor, our outward behavior that could suggest those things that would be the way of applying that today? What's intriguing in that passage, however, is that in 11:5, Paul takes it for granted that the woman will pray or prophesy. It's just how she does it with the appropriate head covering. So that when we come to chapter 14, it says women should be silent. And again, there's about five major explanations, at least as I boil them all down. But the one that can't make any sense without making Paul totally contradicting himself is absolute silence. It must be silence in some particular context. I take the view that it's in the context of evaluating prophecies, because ultimately that devolved to the highest level of the leadership of the church, and that's the context in which Paul's talking anyway in 1 Corinthians 14. Women shall be saved in childbirth. Yeah, this has gone through a number of translations. Even the NIV has gone through about three translations and different editions of that. And here's another place where reading footnotes can be particularly helpful. 1 Timothy 2:15, but women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. But then I read my footnote and I see that the text literally says, but she, it's just the singular pronoun, will be saved through childbearing. But then it switches to the plural pronoun in the Greek. If they continue in faith, love, and holiness. Well, what's going on here? That's not good grammar in English, and it wasn't good grammar in Greek either. The shift must be for a reason. Again, lots of views. Trying to promise to be short. Boiling it all down. I take that as, given that part of the false teaching in Ephesus, go to chapter 4, verse 3, is that some heretics are forbidding people to marry, and therefore within a Christian context to have children. Paul is trying to say, no, don't go that route and absolutely forbid marriage and therefore sexual relations. God's purpose for women as a gender, generically, in the broadest possibility, there are a number of things they can do that men cannot do, and one of the most dramatic is have children. Don't forbid that to women. That is a key purpose of women generically. But plenty of exceptions individually. So what applies to all individual women, as it does to all individual men as well, in terms of spiritual salvation, not just salvation of the human race, has to have propagation to keep it going, is if they continue in faith, i.e. in Jesus, love, holiness with propriety. I hope that's the longest answer I give, but you really asked three questions. So.
Let's go back over to your left.
Yeah, sorry. Just, I keep leaning to the right. I wonder why that is.
It's pretty appropriate, actually, because my question was about 1 Timothy 2, verse 12.
Oh, you just want to back up three verses. Okay.
It says that I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but I'm not sure if that's just Paul or whatnot, because in Acts we also see that he does not allow John Mark to go with him on his missionary journey, but of course John Mark's supposed to go and be a witness to all nations. And two verses before that is very cultural. Lots of cultural references, and I want women to adorn themselves like with proper clothing, yeah. Whatnot. So how would you refer to this verse? Is it cultural? Is it Paul's opinion? Or is it authoritative scripture?
Yeah. Well, as I'm sure you know, and many in the room would know, these kinds of questions are hotly debated these days, and they're hotly debated within evangelical circles. One of the books I don't think was out there, but that's okay. You can't get them all. Is a book that the chair of our counseling department, Denver Seminary, and I co-edited, called Two Views on Women in Ministry. And we put together a package of four authors, two men and two women, one man and one woman complementarian, one man and one woman egalitarian, and all four are North American Evangelical New Testament professors at seminaries. So there's a huge amount of parity. And my passion on this kind of topic is just to really tone the rhetoric way down, because the volume's been turned up, in my opinion, way too high. But since you asked for my opinion, I'll give it, but please don't take it as anything more than that. I don't believe we can deduce anything from any biblical statement that says, I want, I do not want, I permit, I do not permit, because you can find such statements in clearly contextually limited settings and in clearly very timeless, fundamental moral principle settings. So I think that's a cul-de-sac to try to play around with the language of I do or don't permit. What for me is ultimately determinative is nothing in verse 12, but rather verse 13, which appears to ground Paul's command in what some people have called a creation ordinance, or the way God set things up for men and women to be. But then you still have to say, have I translated verse 12 right? Have I understood the grammar right? The word that often is rendered exercise authority can and does in many ancient contexts mean to domineer, or to quote the King James, which isn't usually accused of being very liberal, to usurp authority, to take authority that does not belong to one, not to not have any authoritative role. So there are still all kinds of interpretive issues that aren't settled. But since you didn't ask me those questions, I'll stop here and just say I think the question of timelessness for me is settled by verse 13.
Two-part question. You know, with all the trouble that we have in the Middle East, and the United States has stood strongly beside Israel, and there is a Christian mandate for those people that stand with God's nation Israel or those against it and so forth. Do you agree with that position, that as Christians we should, with the Israel that's there today, that there is a mandate for us to do that? And then secondly, with the Israel that's there today, do you think that has significance in end times prophecy, that there should be an indication that the end of the world is near and so forth?
No, and only maybe. Too short. Okay. Yeah, it's remarkable how people repeat what others have said and what others have said and what people have written, and really don't go back to the New Testament on these kinds of issues. The closest that you get anywhere in the New Testament to somebody having or to Israel having a unique role in the end times is Romans chapter 11. Where at the end of a wonderful, elaborate, Dr. Kaiser would hear, he would call it an allegory, and he would be right, of a olive tree that has branches broken off of it and branches of a wild olive tree grafted onto it. And this represents Jews and Gentiles together combining to form the people of God. As that whole allegory reaches its climax, we read in Romans 11:25, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not think you are superior. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. Now, is that all spiritual Israel, which is what the majority of church history has taught, Jew and Gentile together? Or is that the Jewish people as an ethnic group, as a generalization, not meaning literally every last Israelite? There's an intriguing passage in Mishnah in the tractate Barakot 10:1 that says all Israel will be saved. except murderers, fornicators, perjurers, thieves, and a list of about a dozen other things that disqualifies you. Given that in this context of Romans 11, every other reference to Israel does mean ethnic Jews, I do take it that Paul here is envisioning an outpouring of faith in Jesus as Messiah. Note the next verse, the deliverer will come from Zion, will turn godlessness away from Jacob. Language from Isaiah and then from Jeremiah's New Covenant. Paul is imagining many Jewish people coming to faith in Jesus in the end times. Not a word is said about that having to happen in one particular piece of geography. The only place you find any references to land are in the Old Testament. And then you get into the whole interpretive debate of how does that filter through the grid of New Testament fulfillment? When Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth," he was quoting Psalm 37:11 that said, "Blessed is the meek," implication Jew, "for he or she will inherit the land of Israel." Jesus is just generalized to the whole earth. When he has the conversation with the Samaritan woman in John 4, trying to debate the geography of where you should worship, he says, "The day is coming and now is when you won't worship in this mountain or in Jerusalem." And the point is not that you won't worship anywhere, but that you can worship everywhere. D.A. Carson has, in his commentary on Matthew, referred to W.D. Davies' book, The Gospel and the Land, which makes in several hundred pages, I believe, sensitive. And the woman persists and kneels before him and said, "Lord, help me." And it gets worse. And he replies, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." This was a common Jewish slur for Gentiles. Some people have pointed out that the Greek there is a diminutive form. It's not kuon, it's kunarion. So this is puppies. Ladies, do you feel any better? And besides which, Jews didn't have dogs for house pets, so that's an anachronism anyway. Dogs were wild scavenger dogs. And yet what's remarkable is that if the woman took any offense, we're given not a slightest indication of it. And what we are given indication of is a remarkably tenacious faith in which she enters into his metaphorical world, however seemingly insulting it was, and says, "Yes, Lord. But even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. Even the Gentiles should get some spin-off blessings from the Jews." And then Jesus sounds like the Lord some of us hope he is when he says, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." Again, skipping all the other options for the sake of time, I think Jesus, as he does elsewhere with other people, knew her heart from the moment she arrived. And this was a bit of a test, a bit of a verbal repartee, which he knew would not put her off, but in fact would draw out a public affirmation of trust, not least to show the disciples who just wanted to be rid of her, but would also allow him to praise her in language that particularly in Matthew is very reminiscent of the way he praises the Gentile centurion in Matthew 8, 11 and 12, when he says he has not found such faith in Israel. Very pro-Gentile. But it's a hard passage. Why is it not in Luke and John? There really aren't all that many things that are in more than two Gospels. There are a fair number of accounts that are in three, very few that are in four. The fact that it's in two already means that it's above the 50th percentile. So I'm not sure that's a big issue, and I'm not sure there's any way to answer it.
I was just going to ask you, Dr. Blomberg, what do you believe the fundamental sin of the Pharisees was? Since Luther seems like in conservative evangelical circles, the predominant view is that the Pharisees were law-obsessed, trying to work their way into heaven, and it's this works righteousness that was their primary fundamental sin. But what do you think of the assertion that their fundamental sin was not recognizing the Messiah, God's Messiah?
Which of the following six vices is worse? And then put six things on your list. Yeah, how do you answer a question like that? There certainly has been a huge body of scholarship in the last quarter century on ancient Jewish sources, which has made the point, I think, beyond, how do they say it in court, reasonable doubt, that Judaism in the first century was far more diverse than Luther or Calvin could ever possibly known. Particularly when we limit our focus to sources that are demonstrably pre-Christian, namely the Apocrypha, the Pseudepigrapha, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we tread very cautiously into that encyclopedic body of literature known as the rabbinic literature, because it spanned the 1st through 10th centuries A.D. And many of the traditions, many of the most legalistic manifestations of the Jewish religion don't even develop until after 500 A.D. Certainly not fair to tarnish the Judaism of the first century with those descriptions. Nevertheless, there are some texts in those pre-Christian documents that do pretty clearly tend to suggest at least as Jews dealt with the question of how did someone outside of Judaism, not born to the covenant community, become a part of the covenant community, that obedience to Torah was very central. Probably the best source, if you don't mind a technical one on this, is the two-volume work. Volume 2 has just come out, published by Baker, with the wonderfully exciting title, Justification and Variegated Gnomism, edited by Don Carson, Mark Seifert, and Peter O'Brien. Volume 1 displays the whole breadth of Jewish thinking. Volume 2 applies it to Paul. But here's my answer to your question before I start sounding too much like our previous speaker. I didn't say that. I did not say that. He is gone, right? I love him dearly. What has been called gnomism, some have called it covenantal gnomism, whatever you think of the label, gnomism just meaning from the law, namas, law, may be the most central answer to your question. As long as the question was framed as an intra-Jewish debate. If I'm born as a Jew, to put it in Protestant terms, I never in my life ask the question, how do I get saved? Because I am born saved. The question I ask in a world that seemingly had not yet read Calvin and developed the notion of the perseverance of the saints, or maybe got it from the New Testament, as I think, was how do I stay saved? How do I remain within the covenant community in good standing? And there is a much more subtle form of legalism. One stays saved by sufficient obedience to the Torah. Whatever else you do with the controversial new perspective on Paul, There's one thing that in my mind they are absolutely right on in evangelicals' neglect to their eternal peril. And that is that if we preach a message in which people become saved by grace through no merit of their own, but then turn our perspective on the Christian life into one of following a long list of do's and don'ts going far beyond the biblical absolutes, we have damned people just as much. That might be a good place to transition to...
Join me in thanking Dr. Blomberg, will you?